This is Susan recording at the Talking Information Center. It is Thursday, April 9th, 2026. I'm reading the Medical Hour. Simple therapies beat drugs for knee arthritis pain relief. A new large-scale analysis has identified knee braces, water therapy, and exercise as the most effective non-drug options for managing knee osteoarthritis. The findings come from a meta-analysis published in the open access journal PLOS-1. Knee osteoarthritis is a widespread and often disabling condition that affects millions of older adults. It leads to ongoing pain and stiffness in the knee joint, making everyday movement more difficult. Many patients rely on anti-inflammatory medications, but these drugs can carry risks, including gastrointestinal and cardiovascular side effects. To better understand which non-drug treatments work best, researchers analyzed data from 139 clinical trials involving nearly 10,000 participants. The study compared 12 different therapies, including laser therapy, electrical stimulation, knee braces, insoles, kinesiology tape, water-based therapy, exercise, and ultrasound. By combining results across all of these studies using a network meta-analysis, the researchers were able to rank each treatment based on its effectiveness. Knee braces ranked highest overall, showing strong results in reducing pain, improving joint function, and easing stiffness. Hydrotherapy, exercise or treatment performed in warm water, was especially helpful for pain relief. Regular exercise also delivered consistent benefits, improving both pain levels and physical function. Some advanced treatments such as high-intensity laser therapy and shockwave therapy provided moderate improvements. In contrast, ultrasound consistently ranked as the least effective option. The researchers note that variations in study design, smaller sample sizes in some trials, and differences in how long treatments were used could affect how precise the rankings are. Even so, the overall findings suggest that physical therapy approaches offer meaningful benefits without the risks linked to anti-inflammatory medications. Future research should explore how combining different therapies might improve outcomes further and whether these approaches are cost-effective in real-world care. The authors added, knee braces, hydrotherapy, and exercise are the most effective non-drug therapies for knee osteoarthritis. They reduce pain and improve mobility without the gastrointestinal or cardiovascular risks linked to common pain medications. Patients and clinicians should prioritize these evidence-based options. Our analysis of nearly 10,000 patients reveals that simple, accessible therapies like knee bracing and water-based exercise outperform high-tech options like ultrasound. This could reshape clinical guidelines to focus on safer, lower-cost interventions. Clinical trial shows improvements for spinal cord injuries from the University of Texas at Dallas. In a new clinical study, researchers from the Texas Biomedical Device Center at the University of Texas at Dallas demonstrated unprecedented rates of recovery for spinal cord injuries. In this study, published in the journal Nature, on individuals with incomplete spinal cord injury who safely received a combination of stimulation of a nerve in the neck with progressive individualized rehabilitation. This approach, called closed-loop vagus nerve stimulation, or CLV, produced meaningful improvements in arm and hand function in these individuals. The unprecedented results positioned the UT Dallas scientists to proceed with a pivotal trial, the final hurdle on the road to potential FDA approval of vagus nerve stimulation for the treatment of upper limb impairment due to spinal cord injury. This approach is based on over a decade of neuroscience and bioengineering efforts by investigators at UT Dallas. The therapy uses electrical pulses sent to the brain via a tiny device implanted in the neck and timed to occur during rehabilitative exercises. Previous work by the Dallas researchers has demonstrated that stimulating the vagus nerve during physical therapy can rewire areas of the brain damaged by stroke and lead to improved recovery. Dr. Michael Kilgard, the Johnson Professor of Neuroscience and corresponding author, explained that treating spinal cord injury with CLV is different than conditions targeted in earlier studies. In stroke, people who only do therapy may get better, and adding CLV multiplies that improvement, he said. This study is different. Therapy alone for spinal cord injury did not help our participants at all. The trial involved 19 participants with chronic incomplete cervical spinal cord injury. Each person performed 12 weeks of therapy, playing simple video games to trigger specific upper limb movements. The implant was activated upon successful movements, resulting in significant benefits for arm and hand strength. These activities allow patients to regain strength, speed, range of motion, and hand function. They simplify daily living, said Dr. Robert Reneker, professor of neuroscience and chair in bioengineering, who designed the miniature implanted CLV device. The study served as both a phase 1 and phase 2 clinical trial and included randomized placebo control in its first phase, in which 9 of the 19 participants received sham stimulation rather than active treatment during the first 18 therapy sessions, then received CLV in the latter 18 sessions. The participants ranged in age from 21 to 65 and were from 1 to 45 years post-injury. Neither of those factors nor the severity of the impairment influenced the degree of response to treatment. This approach produces results regardless of these factors, which often cause significant differences in success rates of other types of treatment, says study co-author Dr. Jane Wigginton. It is remarkable from a medical standpoint, said Wigginton, who planned the clinical interactions and patient protections for the trial. The center has worked to treat a wide variety of conditions using CLV across 13 years of research. As a result, the FDA has approved vagus nerve stimulation for treating impaired upper limb movement in stroke patients. Wigginton said the latest results are especially exciting because they help people for whom there is no existing solution. The people in this study have now gained the ability to do things that are meaningful for them and impactful in their lives. The newest generation of the implantable CLV device, designed by Reneker, is approximately 50 times smaller than their version from 3 years ago. It does not prevent patients from receiving MRIs, CAT scans, or ultrasounds. A phase 3 pivotal trial will include 70 participants at multiple institutions in the U.S. that specialize in spinal cord injury. Co-author Dr. Seth Hayes, professor of bioengineering, has been with the CLV project dating back to the earliest studies. Prior to this study, no person with spinal cord injury had ever received CLV, he said. This is the first evidence that gains can be made. Now we will set about determining how we make this optimally effective. Hayes cautioned that it is not a foregone conclusion that the therapy will make it to patients after the next trial. We still have a long road ahead. For many reasons, financial, regulatory, or scientific, this could still die on the vine, he said, but we have positioned ourselves to succeed. The research team emphasized the importance of the dozens of people involved in the work, both the patients and the partners at Baylor Institute for Rehabilitation. This has been the hardest working, most altruistic group of professionals, and that has been incredibly impactful, Wigginton said, noting that even outpatient surgery is complex for those with impaired mobility. Reneker added, these patients said, put that device in me. That's a huge commitment. They deserve credit for paving the path for others. Vitamin D supplements show signs of protection against biological aging, from the Mass General Brigham. Results from the VITAL, The ITAL randomized controlled trial revealed that vitamin D supplementation helps maintain telomeres, protective caps at the ends of chromosomes that shorten during aging and are linked to the development of certain diseases. The new report, which is published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, is based on data from a vital sub-study co-led by researchers at Mass General Brigham and the Medical College of Georgia, and supports a promising role in slowing a pathway for biological aging. Vital is the first large-scale and long-term randomized trial to show that vitamin D supplements protect telomeres and preserve telomere length, said co-author Dr. Joanne Manson. This is of particular interest because Vital had also shown benefits of vitamin D in reducing inflammation and lowering risks of selected chronic diseases of aging, such as advanced cancer and autoimmune disease. Telomeres are made of repeating sequences of DNA or base pairs that prevent chromosome ends from degrading or fusing with other chromosomes. Telomere shortening is a natural part of aging and is associated with an increased risk of various age-related diseases. A few short-term, small-scale studies have suggested that vitamin D or omega-3 fatty acid supplementation may help support telomeres, but results have been inconsistent. Vital is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of vitamin D3 and omega-3 fatty acid supplementation that tracked U.S. females aged 55 and older and males aged 50 and older for 5 years. The sub-study included 1,000 of these patients whose telomere length in white blood cells was assessed at baseline and at year 2 and year 4. Compared with taking placebo, taking vitamin D3 supplements significantly reduced telomere shortening over 4 years, preventing the equivalent of nearly 3 years of aging compared with placebo. Omega-3 fatty acid supplementation had no significant effect on telomere length throughout the follow-up. Our findings suggest that targeted vitamin D supplementation may be a promising strategy to counter a biological aging process. Although further research is warranted, said Dr. Heidong Zhu, first author of the report and a molecular geneticist at the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University. New cholesterol guidelines could change when you get tested, from Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the first time since 2018, the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association have released updated clinical guidance on how to screen for and manage blood cholesterol. The recommendations were published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology and Circulation, and were presented at the American College of Cardiology's 75th annual scientific session in New Orleans. The release comes shortly before a related paper, The ABCs of Cardiovascular Disease Prevention, Communicating What We Know in 2026, appeared in the American Journal of Preventive Cardiology. The updated guidance centers on lowering LDL cholesterol, commonly known as bad cholesterol, along with other blood fats such as lipoprotein A. It also highlights the need for earlier screening, particularly for people with a family history of heart disease, and calls for more individualized risk assessments based on factors like existing health conditions. These steps are intended to support more informed, shared decisions between patients and clinicians. We know that lower LDL cholesterol levels are better when it comes to reducing the risk of heart attack, stroke, and congestive heart failure, says Dr. Roger Blumenthal, chair of the Guideline Writing Committee and director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease. We also know that bringing elevated lipids and blood pressure down in young adults supports optimal heart and vascular health throughout a person's life. The update arrives as research shows that about 1 in 4 adults in the United States has elevated LDL cholesterol, a major contributor to atherosclerosis, the narrowing or hardening of the arteries. When certain lipids build up, they can form plaque inside artery walls. This plaque can restrict blood flow, and under certain conditions, it may rupture and trigger a heart attack or stroke or require urgent medical treatment to restore circulation. Despite these risks, the core advice for maintaining heart health remains unchanged. Experts continue to stress the importance of a balanced diet, regular physical activity, avoiding tobacco, getting enough sleep, and maintaining a healthy weight. According to Blumenthal, roughly 80 to 90% of cardiovascular disease is linked, at least in part, to factors people can modify, making lifestyle changes a critical first step. A key shift in the new guideline is the push for screening at younger ages and a broader look at personal risk. Doctors are encouraged to consider family history of atherosclerosis, underlying conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, and life events like early menopause or pregnancy complications, including preeclampsia or gestational diabetes, when evaluating the risk and planning treatment. For instance, individuals with familial hypercholesterolemia, a genetic condition that causes very high LDL levels, should now begin screening earlier in life, starting at around age 9 or earlier. The guidance also recommends a one-time test for lipoprotein, which is tied to inherited risk and can raise heart disease risk by about 40%. Another major update is the introduction of a new tool for estimating 10 and 30-year risk of heart attack and stroke. The previous model focused mainly on 10-year risk for adults age 40 and older and relied on basic factors such as age, cholesterol levels, and blood pressure. The new calculator, predicting risk of cardiovascular disease events, or also known as PREVENT, includes additional measures such as blood sugar and kidney function. It is designed for use starting at age 30 and is based on data from 6.6 million people compared to just 26,000 in the earlier model. Shifting the paradigm toward proactive prevention strategies earlier in life can meaningfully challenge and change the trajectory of cardiovascular disease and lead to better health outcomes for people decades later, says Dr. Seth Martin, a cardiologist and member of the guideline writing committee. To further refine risk estimates, the guideline outlines additional factors doctors may consider, referred to as risk enhancers. For people with borderline or moderate risk, clinicians may use extra tests to guide decisions. These can include measuring inflammation through high-sensitivity C-reactive protein levels and reviewing family history and ancestry. Imaging tools such as coronary artery calcium scans are also recommended to detect calcium deposits that signal plaque buildup, helping to tailor treatment plans more precisely. The updated guidance addresses treatment strategies for a wide range of groups, including pregnant or breastfeeding individuals, adults age 75 and older, and people with conditions such as diabetes, advanced kidney disease, HIV, or cancer. In addition to statins, the guidelines include updated recommendations on other cholesterol-lowering therapies. These options are particularly important for individuals who do not respond well to statins or require multiple therapies to reduce their LDL. For people without cardiovascular disease, LDL levels below 100 milligrams per deciliter are considered optimal. Those at intermediate risk are advised to lower levels below 70, while high-risk individuals should aim for less than 55. The guideline also includes targets for non-HDL cholesterol and lipoprotein B. In an accompanying editorial, experts suggest that future recommendations may further emphasize lowering LDL to below 55 for people with moderate atherosclerosis. This direction is supported by findings from the clinical trial known as Vesalius, which showed benefits from aggressively lowering cholesterol using a combination of therapies. The 2026 guideline on the management of dyslipidemia was developed by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association in collaboration with multiple medical organizations focused on cardiovascular health, prevention, and patient care. New genetic tests can diagnose brain tumors in as little as 2 hours from the University of Nottingham. Scientists and medics have developed an ultra-rapid method of genetically diagnosing brain tumors that will cut the time it takes to classify them from 6 to 8 weeks to as little as 2 hours, which could improve care for thousands of patients each year in the UK. The groundbreaking method, which is detailed in a new study published in Neuro-Oncology, has been developed by scientists at the University of Nottingham, along with Nottingham University Hospital clinicians of the NHS Trust. In the published work, the team at NU Hospital utilized the new approach during 50 brain tumor surgeries to deliver rapid intraoperative diagnoses. This approach has achieved a 100% success rate, providing diagnostic results in under 2 hours from surgery and detailed tumor classifications within minutes of sequencing. Moreover, the platform's ability to continue sequencing enables a fully integrated diagnosis within 24 hours. Every day in the UK, approximately 34 people are diagnosed with some form of brain tumor, equating to more than 12,000 cases a year. The average survival rate can be less than a year for the most aggressive brain cancers. Brain tumors require complex genetic tests to diagnose, which clinicians currently have to send away to centralized analysis facilities. It can take 6 to 8 weeks or more to get full results to be able to inform patients what type of tumor they have and their prognosis. This long wait is extremely traumatic for patients and also delays the start of radiotherapy and chemotherapy, which may reduce the chances of the treatment working. The team of experts in Nottingham have developed an ultra-rapid way of genetically diagnosing brain tumors that will eliminate this delay. The method is so quick that they can even get results within a couple of hours and potentially make this information available to the surgeon during the operation to inform surgical decision-making. Dr. Stuart Smith, a neurosurgeon from the School of Medicine at the university, said, "Traditionally, the process of diagnosing brain tumors has been slow and expensive. Now, with this new technology, we can do more for patients because we can get answers so much more quickly, which will have a bigger influence on clinical decision-making in as little as 2 hours. Patients find waiting many weeks for results extremely difficult, and this adds to the anxiety and worry at what is already a very difficult time. This type of operation can be quite long, so potentially a surgeon could be informed during the surgery of the accurate diagnosis, which would then impact on the surgical strategy. The current treatment pathway starts with an MRI scan to ascertain the presence of a tumor. Patients will speak to clinicians to discuss the possibilities of what type of tumor they may have. For many tumor types, people would then undergo some form of surgery to obtain a sample of the tumor, which is currently sent away to centralized labs for testing to look for abnormalities in the DNA, which determine what type of tumor it is. Traditionally, experts would then look at the specimens, and the neuropathology view would be to try and identify the cells visually. But in the last few years, the process has changed and tumors are categorized on the DNA and genetic abnormalities, which traditionally is a slow process due to technological limitations. Professor Matt Luce, a biologist from the School of Life Sciences at Nottingham, developed a method to sequence specific parts of human DNA at higher depth using Oxford Nanopore Technologies portable sequencing devices. This method allows relevant parts of the human genome to be examined much more quickly and multiple regions of DNA sequenced at the same time, speeding up the whole process. The team have now used this method to genetically test brain tumor samples. Robin, a software tool based on the P2 Prometheon nanopore sequencers, sequences the DNA by detecting the change in current flow as single molecules of DNA pass through a nanopore, or tiny hole in a membrane. Professor Luce said, when we were first able to sequence an entire human genome in 2018, it took around 5 labs and 6 months to do, which obviously isn't ideal when time is of the essence for the patient. This new method allows us to choose the bits of DNA that we need to look at in order to answer specific questions, such as what type of tumor and how it can be treated. Combined with our later research, where we were able to look at relevant parts of the human genome more quickly, we now have a process where we can use Robin to create comprehensive classifications of tumors more quickly. Once we have a sample from a patient, we can now quickly extract the DNA and look at the different properties to give us information we need. Methylation is the one we are most interested in early on in this instance because that defines the tumor type. Once a sample has been removed during surgery, it is sent to the pathology lab where they would extract DNA before it is being sent to the team to sequence. Dr. Simon Payne, a consultant neuropathologist at Nottingham, said, "This new method of diagnosing brain tumors is going to be a game changer. It really is revolutionary. It not only increases the speed at which the results will be available, but the degree of accuracy of the diagnosis as well is incredible. The team are now looking to get the new testing rolled out at NHS sites across the UK. Not only is the test more accurate and quicker, but it is also cheaper than current methods," said Professor Luce. "Our calculations stand at around £450 per person, potentially less when scaled up. There are a few reasons for this. Our method can eliminate the need for 4 to 5 separate tests, reducing costs as a consequence, as we are getting more information from the single test we do. Most importantly, it delivers results to the patients when they need them." Dr. Simon Newman, Chief Scientific Officer at the Brain Tumor Charity, said, "The delivery of an accurate diagnosis within hours of surgery will be transformative for all patients, ensuring rapid access to the optimal standard of care and, crucially, removing the uncertainty patients face when having to wait weeks for their diagnosis and prognosis. The potential to combine so many separate tests into one and deliver at a localized level is a game changer for driving equity of access to rapid and accurate molecular diagnosis. The Brain Matrix trial, funded by the Brain Tumor Charity, is now exploring how this technology can match patients to personalized clinical trials across the UK. Handheld device could transform heart disease screening, from the University of Cambridge. Researchers have developed a handheld device that could potentially replace stethoscopes as a tool for detecting certain types of heart disease. The researchers from the University of Cambridge developed a device that makes it easy for people with or without medical training to record heart sounds accurately. Unlike a stethoscope, the device works well even if it's not placed precisely on the chest. Its larger, flexible sensing area helps capture clearer heart sounds than traditional stethoscopes. The device can also be used over clothing, making it more comfortable for patients, especially women, during routine checkups or community heart health screening programs. The heart sound recordings can be saved on the device, which can then be used to detect signs of heart valve disease. The researchers are also developing a machine learning algorithm, which can detect signs of valve disease automatically. The results are reported in the IEEE Journal of Biomedical and Health Informatics. Heart valve disease has been called the next cardiac epidemic, with a prognosis worse than many forms of cancer. Up to 50% of patients with significant valvular disease remain undiagnosed, and many patients only see their doctor when the disease has advanced and they are experiencing significant complications. In the UK, the NHS and the NICE have identified early detection of heart valve disease as a key goal, both to improve quality of life for patients and to decrease costs. An examination with a stethoscope or auscultation is the way that most diagnoses of heart valve disease are made. However, just 38% of patients who present their GP with symptoms of valve disease receive an examination with a stethoscope. The symptoms of valvular heart disease can be easily confused with certain respiratory conditions, which is why so many patients don't receive a stethoscope exam, said Professor Anurag Agarwal from Cambridge's Department of Engineering, who led the research. However, the accuracy of stethoscope examination for diagnosing valvular heart disease is fairly poor, and it requires a GP to conduct the examination. In addition, a stethoscope exam requires patients to partially undress, which is both time-consuming in short appointments and can be uncomfortable for patients, particularly for female patients in routine screening programs. The gold standard for diagnosing heart valve disease is an echocardiogram, but this can only be done in a hospital, and NH waiting lists are extremely long, between 6 to 9 months at many hospitals. To help get waiting lists down and to make sure we're diagnosing heart valve disease early enough that simple interventions can improve quality of life, we wanted to develop an alternative to a stethoscope that is easy to use as a screening tool, said Agarwal. Agarwal and colleagues have developed a handheld device about the diameter of a drinks coaster that could be a solution. Their device can be used by any health professional to accurately record heart sounds and can be used over clothes. While a regular or electronic stethoscope has a single sensor, the Cambridge-developed device has six, meaning it is easier for the doctor or nurse, or even someone without medical training, to get an accurate reading, simply because the surface area is so much bigger. The device contains materials that can transmit vibration so that it can be used over clothes, which is particularly important when conducting community programs. Between each of the six sensors is a gel that absorbs vibration, so the sensors don't interfere with each other. The researchers tested the device on healthy participants with different body shapes and sizes and recorded their heart sounds. Their next steps will be to test the device in a clinical setting on a variety of patients against results from an echocardiogram. In parallel with the development of the device, the researchers have developed a machine learning algorithm that can use the recorded heart sounds to detect signs of valve disease automatically. Early tests of the algorithm suggest that it outperforms GPs in detecting heart valve disease. If successful, this device could become an affordable and scalable solution for heart health screening, especially in areas with limited medical resources, said Agarwal. The researchers say the device could be a useful tool to triage patients who are waiting for an echocardiogram so that those with signs of valve disease can be seen sooner. A patent has been filed by Cambridge Enterprise, the university's commercialization arm. Anurag Agarwal is a fellow of Emmanuel College, Cambridge. After cardiac event, people who regularly sit for too long had higher risk of another event, from the American Heart Association. People who sit or remain sedentary for more than 14 hours a day may have a higher risk of cardiovascular event or death in the year after treatment for symptoms of a heart attack, such as chest pain, according to new research published in the American Heart Association's peer-reviewed scientific journal, Circulation. Previous research from the study authors found that people who had experienced a heart attack were spending up to 12 to 13 hours each day being sedentary, defined as any awake activity that involved little to no physical movement. In this study, the researchers used a wrist accelerometer to track the amount of time each participant spent moving or being sedentary for a median of 30 days after discharge from a hospital's emergency department. Wrist accelerometers measure the acceleration of motion in three directions, forwards and backwards, side to side, and up and down. These measurements allowed the researchers to infer the intensity of a participant's physical activity, and they provide more accurate measurements of the participant's time spent moving, rather than asking participants to remember. Some examples of moderate intensity physical activities are brisk walking, water aerobics, dancing, playing doubles tennis, or gardening. And examples of vigorous intensity are running, lap swimming, heavy yard work, playing singles tennis, or jumping rope. Current treatment guidelines after a cardiac event focus mainly on encouraging patients to exercise regularly, said study lead author Keith Diaz, PhD, at Columbia University. A certified exercise physiologist and volunteer member of the American Heart Association's Physical Activity Science Committee. In our study, we explored whether sedentary time itself may contribute to cardiovascular risk. Researchers followed more than 600 adults aged 21 to 96 treated for a heart attack or chest pain in the emergency department at a single hospital in New York. Participants wore a wrist accelerometer for a median of 30 consecutive days after hospital discharge to measure the amount of time they spent sitting or being inactive each day. Additional cardiac events and deaths were evaluated 1 year after hospital discharge via telephone surveys with patients, electronic health records, and the Social Security Death Index. The study was focused on understanding the risk of sedentary behavior and identifying modifiable risk factors that may improve long-term outcomes in this risk group. Compared to participants in the group with the highest physical activity level, those in the group with the lowest activity level had a 2.58 times higher risk of having another heart problem or dying within the next year. Replacing 30 minutes of sedentary time with 30 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity daily reduced the risk of adverse cardiovascular events or death by 61%. Replacing the sedentary time with light intensity activity reduced the risk by 50%. And replacing the sedentary time with 30 minutes of sleep lowered the risk by 14%. According to the accelerometer data, participants in the most physically active group had average daily physical activity measurements of 143.8 minutes of light physical activity, 25 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity, 11.7 hours sedentary, and 8.4 hours of sleep. Participants in the least physically active group had averages of 82 minutes each day of light activity, 2.7 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity, 15.6 hours sedentary, and 6.6 hours of sleep. Participants in the group in between had daily averages of 109 minutes of light activity, 11 minutes of moderate activity, 13.5 hours sedentary, and 7.8 hours of sleep. We were surprised that replacing sedentary time with sleep also lowered risk. Sleep is a restorative behavior that helps the body and mind recover, which is especially important after a serious health event like a heart attack, Diaz said. Our study indicates that one doesn't have to start running marathons after a cardiovascular event to see benefits. Sitting less and moving more, or sleeping a little more, can make a real difference. More physical activity and more sleep are healthier than sitting, so we hope these findings support health professionals to move toward a more holistic, flexible, and individualized approach for physical activity in patients after a heart attack or chest pain. Physical activity and sleep are both key components of the American Heart Association's Life Essential 8, a list of health behaviors and factors that support optimal cardiovascular health. Poor sleep is a known risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which claims more lives each year in the United States than all forms of cancer and chronic lower respiratory disease combined. In addition to sleep duration, a recent scientific statement from the association highlighted the importance of sleep continuity, sleep timing, sleep satisfaction, sleep regularity, sleep-related daytime functioning, and sleep architecture in cardiometabolic health. The study had several limitations, including that the definition of sedentary behavior was based only on the intensity level of physical movement, meaning that the study may have overestimated the time participants spent in sedentary behavior. Additionally, there was no information about the participants' income and characteristics of the neighborhood where they live, which limits the study's ability to account for social and environmental factors, including the participants' risk of one-year cardiac events and death. Also, hospital discharge information about whether patients were sent home, referred to rehabilitation, or referred to other care centers was not collected. This limited the study's ability to fully assess whether the patient's settings had an impact on their recovery. This study provides further support for a sit less, move more strategy and is important for patients recently hospitalized for acute coronary syndrome who may have barriers to more intense exercise, said Bethany Gibbs, PhD, professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at West Virginia University, and immediate past chair of the American Heart Association's Physical Activity Committee. This study found that replacing sedentary time with light intensity activities, such as tidying up the house or strolling at a slow pace, was nearly as beneficial as moderate to vigorous physical activity. In addition, replacing just 30 minutes of sedentary behavior with activity of any intensity more than halved the risk of having a cardiac event over the one-year follow-up, she said. These findings suggest sitting less and doing anything else, like taking a walk, cooking, playing with your dog, or gardening, will help you stay healthier. New guidelines may help shorten endometriosis diagnosis times, from Medical News. Historically, endometriosis has been hard to diagnose because many of its symptoms, such as pain during the menstrual cycle, chronic fatigue, nausea, and constipation, vary and are shared with several other conditions, such as irritable bowel syndrome, ovarian cysts, and pelvic inflammatory disease. Patients with endometriosis can experience significant delays in diagnosis, said Dr. Bliss Kanashiro, professor in the Department of Obstetrics at the Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii. For some, it takes years of experiencing pain before an endometriosis diagnosis is made. During this time, some patients can experience progression of disease, which can affect their quality of life. Guidance that leads to quicker diagnosis can assist providers and help patients in a more timely manner. Kanashiro is one of the authors of these updated guidelines issued by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. For the first time, these guidelines offer comprehensive recommendations for diagnosing endometriosis. The updated guidelines also address barriers to care arising from racial and gender identity bias and emphasize the importance of shared decision-making between the doctor and the patient in endometriosis care. The college's updated endometriosis guidelines reportedly include comprehensive recommendations on diagnosis for the first time. Historically, endometriosis guidance has been fragmented, being discussed in pieces and suggestions rather than addressed in a unified, clear, structured way, said Dr. Jocelyn Carlo, director of gynecology at Hackensack Medical Center, who was not involved in the writing of the guidelines. Having comprehensive criteria matters because endometriosis is not a one-dimensional disease. It presents differently from patient to patient and can affect multiple organ systems and overlap with other pain symptoms. The new clinical guidelines validate what many patients have been experiencing for years. Endometriosis can cause both pelvic and extrapelvic symptoms, and those symptoms are real, meaningful, and medically important. The updated guidelines offer strategies to help clinicians reduce barriers to care. erroneous beliefs about biological differences between people of different races have contributed to disparities in endometriosis diagnosis, Dr. Kaneshiro said. Transgender men and others may face unique barriers when presenting for endometriosis care. We need to be aware of this. Endometriosis has been underrecognized in marginalized populations, said Dr. Stephen Vasilev, founder of the Lotus Endometriosis Institute in Santa Monica, California, who was not involved in developing the guidelines. The updated guidelines place an emphasis on the importance of shared decision-making between doctor and patients in endometriosis care. Patient-centered care prioritizes the needs of each individual and acknowledges that different patients may experience endometriosis differently. Our job as providers is to give patients the information they need to make a healthcare decision that is best for them, said Dr. Kaneshiro. Routine mammograms may help predict heart disease, from Medical News. Despite roughly 90% of women in the United States having at least one cardiovascular risk factor, appropriate management of heart disease risk in women remains a major opportunity gap. Many health experts support strategies to improve screening and awareness of cardiovascular disease in women. Guidelines for screening usually vary depending on an individual's risk. Most people think mammograms only identify breast cancer. However, new research published in the European Heart Journal suggests an AI tool may be able to detect the risk of developing serious heart disease by analyzing routine mammograms. Researchers say the approach could turn a widely used breast cancer screening tool into a way to also identify those at risk of cardiovascular disease. In the new study, researchers developed an AI tool capable of measuring the amount of calcium in breast arteries from standard mammogram images. The researchers analyzed data from 123,000 women who underwent breast cancer screening and had no known cardiovascular disease at the start of the study. Using the AI tool, the team categorized the amount of arterial calcification visible in the mammograms as absent, mild, moderate, or severe. They then compared these findings with later records of cardiovascular events, such as heart attack, stroke, heart failure, or death from heart disease. The results showed a clear relationship between the amount of calcification and the likelihood of developing serious cardiovascular disease. Females with mild calcification were about 30% more likely to experience cardiovascular disease compared to those with none. Those with moderate calcification had a more than 70% higher risk. The association remained even after accounting for other known risk factors, such as diabetes and smoking. Dr. Lori Daniels, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at UC San Diego, was not surprised by the strength of the association between the breast artery calcification and future cardiovascular events. Her group previously published similar findings highlighting an association between higher calcification levels and heart disease risk. The present study is in that ballpark. Their age-adjusted model is almost identical in magnitude, Daniel said. Our 2024 study also showed that breast artery calcification was particularly informative in younger women. This is important because younger women are the ones least likely to already know that they are at increased cardiovascular risk. Importantly, the findings of the study also observe that the relationship between breast artery calcification and cardiovascular risk is present in women under the age of 50, a group often considered to be at lower risk of heart disease. As many females already undergo routine mammography, the technique could reveal cardiovascular risk earlier than traditional screening methods and provide heart health insights without requiring additional tests or procedures. Implementing the approach would involve integrating the AI tool into imaging systems and developing guidelines for notifying clinicians and patients about the findings. If integrated into clinical practice, AI-based analysis of mammograms could prompt earlier discussions between patients and doctors about preventive strategies such as cholesterol testing, lifestyle changes, or medication. One might argue that if a woman is already at increased risk, how is this helpful? The biggest public impact will be in identifying risk in those women who do not already know they are at risk. In an accompanying editorial by Dr. Daniels, experts note that many females regularly receive mammograms but do not know their cholesterol levels, which are a major cardiovascular risk factor. Using mammography to also assess heart disease risk could help close this gap and identify those who might otherwise go undiagnosed. However, the authors note that further research and clinical trials are necessary before the technology can be widely implemented. A step closer to the confident production of blood stem cells for regenerative medicine from the Joseph Carreras Leukemia Research Institute. Researchers from the stem cells and cancer team at the Joseph Carreras Leukemia Research Institute and the Hospital Del Mar Research Institute have developed a method to confidently produce blood cell precursors from stem cells in mice by activating a set of 7 key genes in the laboratory. The team, led by Dr. Anna Bigas, takes a step forward toward the production of precursor cells able to restore the bone marrow of blood cancer patients in a successful example of regenerative medicine. Stem cells can produce any other cell type. It is a matter of telling them in the right way. From a biological perspective, this means activating the proper genetic program by pressing the right keys. This is the right genes at the right moment. Quite often, blood cancer patients require the replacement of their blood stem cells in the bone marrow, the tissue that produces blood cells, and also where their cancer grows. Unfortunately, finding a compatible donor happens to be too challenging sometimes. What if we could produce the cells that make the blood in the lab from basic stem cells and use them to regenerate a new and healthy bone marrow? To do this, you would need to know what genes to activate in a stem cell. In a tour de force, the team led by Dr. Anna Bigas screened thousands of genes in the mice genome to see which were able to transform an embryonic stem cell into a blood precursor, or more technically, a hematopoietic stem cell. The screening identified a group of 7 genes apparently able to accomplish the task. In subsequent experiments, the team confirmed that the timely activation of the 7 genes was sufficient to transform mouse embryonic stem cells into hematopoietic stem cells, and that these newly produced cells were able to regenerate and sustain a functional blood system, producing all kinds of blood cells, including the immune lineages in adult mice. The research has been published at the journal Blood, the official outlet of the American Society of Hematology, authored by Dr. Luis Galan Palma in collaboration with other researchers at the Joseph Carreras Leukemia Institute. Dr. Bigas is confident that the results obtained in mice can be translated into the human system, since despite the differences, the mechanisms driving stem cell differentiation are so fundamental that are shared between species. As Dr. Bigas points out, we know that those genes are also present in the human genome, and they are highly conserved, that is, their genetic sequences are almost identical. Research is on the way, but chances are they really play the same role in humans and in mice. The research is proof of concept for the Bigas Labs and synergy-funded project Making Blood, a highly ambitious endeavor to develop a technological platform aimed at the production of human hematopoietic stem cells off the shelf. If successful, we are just a few years away of a new era in the treatment of leukemia and other blood disorders based on the long-awaited regenerative medicine. Are NAD supplements the fountain of youth? Longevity expert weighs in from Medical News. Recent studies on aging have latched onto a player in longevity that had hitherto received little attention, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD for short. NAD is a molecule sometimes derived from vitamin B3, niacin, and it occurs in every living cell of the body. It plays complex roles for health, but the latest research in Nature Metabolism emphasizes the role that NAD depletion plays in aging, suggesting that replenishing NAD stores may help slow down aging processes. This has raised questions about whether NAD dietary supplements could be an effective tool for boosting longevity. Given that NAD is so intricately involved in cellular processes and cellular health, it follows that it is a key factor in the most basic aspects of aging. But what does this mean in terms of replenishing NAD stores? Is it possible to reverse this natural process? Although NAD is continuously recycled in the body, aging, inflammation, and metabolic stress can lower its availability. Supplementation with precursors has been shown to increase NAD levels, though long-term outcome data remain limited. Some caveats remain. There is no miracle cure for aging, and while vitamin B3 supplements can play a positive role in health, we should be wary of treating them as a panacea. For those who are curious to try it, it should be considered a metabolic support strategy within a broader longevity framework rather than a standalone anti-aging intervention, reports Seblum Unlussler, Chief Longevity Officer and Genetic Engineer at the London Regenerative Institute.